Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, May 7th. So negotiations are underway in the press, and maybe even between the leaders in Washington themselves, over the next relief package. One of the main tensions, as we've been discussing here in recent days, is between cities like New York and Chicago that feel they have tremendous financial problems being caused by emergency virus spending and plummeting tax revenues at the same time, that only the federal government is big enough to help them meet. Cities on the one side, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and President Trump on the other, who are resisting what they call blue state bailouts. Trump wants a payroll tax cut. McConnell wants businesses that reopen protected from lawsuits. Here is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on CNN with Wolf Blitzer this week, one of her latest acts of Donald Trump management, as she sees it, making the city's case as part of her blueprint for the next bill.
We didn't just start this bill yesterday. This bill was what we were in the works with CARES 1. They did 150 for state and local. It wasn't enough. We're continuing that. And we did testing in our first bill March 4th and then testing last week, but we need more for
so
that.
If the president says, Madam Speaker, excuse me for interrupting, if the president says you could get most of what you want, but he wants a payroll tax cut, otherwise he's not going to sign it into law, what are you going to do?
Well, I'm not negotiating with the president on television right here. And he didn't say that. He started denigrating governors who are fighting the fight in their states to save lives and save livelihoods for their people.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi with Wolf Blitzer on CNN. With us now is Time Magazine national correspondent Molly Ball. Molly has a new book about the speaker, simply called Pelosi. Molly, always good to have you on. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much, Brian, and thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So to start on the news, can you put the clip we just heard in context? Pelosi said she won't negotiate with the president in the press. Are they negotiating with each other in private?
No, and she hasn't spoken to the president himself in several months. He has sort of been mad at her over impeachment. But she has been, you know, she had been on the previous set of packages of coronavirus legislation, been negotiating with the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, with whom she has developed a good working relationship. At this point, though, as you alluded to at the top there, most of the negotiation is happening in public. It's the sort of skirmishing, putting out statements, drawing lines, and so on, which you summarized quite well. But I don't have the sense that any real negotiations are happening behind closed doors. You have the Senate Republicans in particular not seeming to see any particular urgency to the next phase of legislation. Mitch McConnell saying that this may take a while.
Democrats tend to be outraged by McConnell's demand for liability protection for businesses that reopen because they see it as giving businesses carte blanche to not offer workers PPEs or protect their workers or customers in any way to make an easier buck, and nobody can hold them accountable for that willful negligence in cases where it is willful negligence. What's McConnell's argument on the other side?
Yeah, I think that is a good description of Democrats' argument against it. McConnell's argument is when businesses do begin to reopen, they have to be protected from what Republicans might see as an excess of litigiousness, the frivolous lawsuits brought by people who, you know, when in cases where businesses did take whatever precautions they could, but couldn't ensure everything given the spread of the virus, and wanting to be able to have the economy reopen in a way that doesn't put business owners at more risk than they already are. So that's going to be, you know, that's been the opening demand of the Republicans. You mentioned the president also has said he wants this payroll tax cut. Even a lot of Republicans have said they're not as interested in that. It sounds like the principal demands are going to be the Democrats wanting funding for state and local governments and Republicans wanting these liability protections.
So do you see the framework of a deal for some kind of limited immunity that maybe does protect businesses from frivolous lawsuits, as you put it a minute ago, that Democrats can live with, but doesn't protect businesses from real negligence in exchange for emergency aid to states and cities?
I wouldn't be surprised to see something along those lines, but I certainly can't speak for the parties involved about where they'll eventually end up.
Yeah. Now, this is radio, so the listeners cannot see the cover art on your book, but it's a photo of the speaker that you find to be a significant image of her in the Trump era. Would you describe your cover for the listeners?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you mentioned it. I had nothing to do with the design, so I'm free to boast about how beautiful it is on behalf of the artists who did create it. But it is that iconic, I think, photo of Nancy Pelosi walking out of the White House in that reddish-orange coat and the tortoiseshell sunglasses and smiling, sort of seemingly smiling to herself a little bit. This was the meeting with Trump that she and Chuck Schumer went to in December 2018 when they were before the government had shut down, when she was still embroiled in a battle to regain the speakership for the second time. And that image lit up 1,000 memes. And I argue that it is symbolic of the way her image has changed in the current era, when I think the explosion of women's participation in politics, particularly on the left, and just overall changes in society and culture have really changed the way that she's regarded after many years of her being seen as sort of a burden, even by many Democrats. I think she's being celebrated a lot more.
You described the coronavirus bills that Speaker Pelosi is negotiating with Trump and McConnell as a fitting capstone to her historic three-decade career. How is it a capstone in that arc of history?
Well, I think it's fair to say she's in the latter stages of her career. She recently turned 80 years old, and she doesn't talk about when or if she might consider retiring. But she did accept a term limit to when she last took the speakership last year. And, you know, it is one of a series of emergency negotiations she's participated in going back to her first speakership that began in 2007. And there are a lot of parallels if you look at particularly the TARP that she negotiated with, you know, at the time an unpopular Republican president who was asking the Democratic Speaker of the House to help him, potentially help him politically, to shore up and rescue a crashing U.S. economy. So there's a lot of similarities,
right?
Between
yeah.
that and the current situation. Yeah. And I would argue that in that case, and probably in this one, she has put the needs of the country ahead of her party's political interests to collaborate on these bipartisan deals. Now, that's not to say she's not making demands. She believes that she deserves a seat at the table, that the House Democrats were put in charge of the House by the American people for a reason, and they need to be part of the negotiations. But she's not going to walk away from the situation just because it might put the president at more risk politically.
I think I heard you say on TV the other day that it's really interesting the way Pelosi has combined femininity and strength, and that it's been a different approach than, say, Hillary Clinton running for president, especially in her 2008 campaign. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, that is an observation that I made, and I'm happy to repeat it or flesh it out if you're interested. I think that's one of the really interesting things about her public persona is that, you know, there hasn't been a woman president. She's the only woman Speaker of the House. In fact, the only woman ever to lead a party in either House of Congress. So she's sort of blazed a new trail for the way women can represent themselves and make their image in politics. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, when you look at, she entered Congress in 1987 when out of 435 members of the House of Representatives, there were 23 women. And that number has only in the past year reached 100. So she had to figure out how to get herself taken seriously in these very male-dominated institutions. And one way that a lot of women tried to do that was by essentially sort of impersonating a man, trying to be strong, trying to be to emulate the sort of masculine qualities that I think are stereotypically associated with leadership historically. And she didn't do that. She has always foregrounded her femininity, her family, talking about children being her motivation for being in politics. And at the same time, forcing men to take her seriously by using her her negotiating and legislative skills and building alliances.
In fact, you write that many scholars consider Pelosi the most adept lawmaker of the past half century. Why do they come to that conclusion?
Well, if you just look at her record of being able to get things done, particularly in an era when the Congress has been very polarized, very divided, look at the two Republican speakers who served in between her two stints as speaker. They both faced these constant rebellions from their right flank that essentially shut down the Congress. They weren't able to advance a lot of legislation, particularly anything big and bipartisan. And she's got a record, you know, she calls the Affordable Care Act her proudest accomplishment. That is something that Democratic presidents and lawmakers have been trying to achieve for the better part of a century, some form of universal access to health care. So I think she's got a long list of accomplishments that she can point to in, and I think it's all the more impressive given the political era that we're in, where, you know, it's so polarized, so divided, and so partisan, she has still been able to get things done.
And on the Affordable Care Act, you describe Obama trying to negotiate with congressional Republicans on things like health care and bills to control global warming, and Pelosi telling him he was naive. Was there a specific interaction?
They had various conversations, but in general, that was her take on the situation. And I think in retrospect, she and a lot of probably members of the Obama administration would say that she ended up being right. You have to remember, you know, she got to Congress at sort of the tail end of the earlier era when committee chairmen were powerful and a lot of and the parties were more ideologically mixed. So there was a lot more bipartisanship. But she lived through the Republican takeover of the Congress in 94 and the Newt Gingrich Republican Revolution, which is where a lot of scholars point to a real sort of sea change in the way the House in particular operated. And so she has been part of a different era. She's seen the Republican Party evolve in a different direction. And from the beginning of the Obama administration, she was telling the president, there's a quote during the ACA passage where she said to Rahm Emanuel, who was chief of staff at the time, I believe, saying, you know, the president wants to get things done and wants to be beloved. He can't have both. Which one does he want? And so, you know, the President Obama did spend years trying to get the Republicans to come to the table and collaborate with him. But it was mostly fruitless, and she ended up being right.
I'm going to take a call from a listener in Queens, which is maybe the single most common question we've been getting or observation from a New York City perspective on this resistance by McConnell to helping the states with the pandemic expenses and referring to things like a blue state bailout. John in Queens Village, you're on WNYC with Time Magazine's Molly Ball. Hi, John.
Hey, Brian. Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you okay.
Good. Okay. Yeah, my point is that Mitch McConnell basically, as far as I can tell, he basically came in to strength. He rode in on, you mentioned on, since you mentioned just a minute ago, on Newt Gingrich, basically revolution for the Republicans. So he took great advantage of that. And my point really is very simple that, well, on the one hand, he's telling states like New York to, you know, go get broke, if you will, or take, you know, go for bankruptcy. But in effect, Kentucky, where he is, I believe the number is something like over $30,000 per capita that Kentucky receives from the federal government. New York City still gives more than it gets from the federal government. So this is almost the same idea as Palin had when she talked about, let's say, Alaska being self-dependent and didn't need anybody. In fact, they have nothing in Alaska except what's underground. So once petroleum goes down or oil goes down, that's the end. You know, they've got nothing to offer.
Right. Let me get a thought from Molly on this. And for listeners who don't know this issue and this argument, and we've been hearing it a lot from Chuck Schumer and other Democrats, It's something that a lot of Americans don't think about, that some states pay more in federal taxes. Of course, it's the people from those states who pay more in federal taxes than the state gets back from the federal government. Some states' people pay less than the state gets back in total. And as it turns out, New York is a state that pays a lot more into Washington's total coffers than it gets back. So is New Jersey. So is California. And it's a lot of red states in the South where the politics are being against big government, where they actually get a net plus from Washington, where the blue states get a net minus. Molly, from either side of that equation, how does this make any political sense at all?
Well, the calculation that the Democrats are making is that it won't make political sense for the Republicans to continue to resist helping to bail out the states, because it isn't just a blue state problem. This is, red states are having their budgets blown up by this crisis as well, and we are seeing Republican governors and some mayors call on their representatives as well to support funding for the states and localities. So there was a lot of angst about the Democrats' failure to secure this funding in the last package. And we had, you know, officials like Governor Cuomo blasting the Democrats in Congress as well as the Republicans for not including what they say is just, you know, urgently necessary funding. Most states are not able to go into debt. They have to balance their budgets. And the case that they make is, you know, if they have to do mass layoffs, that hurts both their ability to respond to the coronavirus and also the economic picture that is already so dismal across the country and that we know the president and others are very concerned about. So, you know, in the face of that kind of criticism, I think Pelosi and the Democrats in Congress are calculating that that political pressure will become overwhelming and the Republicans in Congress will not be able to resist it. And eventually they will be able to secure that funding. But it's, you know, it's a really difficult situation for all of these state governments, and they really feel like the federal government, you know, told them to shut down and then refused to help them get the resources to do it.
You tell a story in the book of where Pelosi and a Pennsylvania Democratic congressman named Murtha played a coordinated trick on the Bush administration regarding the Iraq war. Do I have this right? Murtha was pretending to be against Pelosi on something about war policy, but it was really all an act?
Not exactly, but that is sort of what happened. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, Nancy Pelosi was one of the most senior Democrats to oppose the Iraq war in 2003. Jack Murtha, who had been one of her mentors, a conservative sort of gruff, hawkish former Marine from Pennsylvania, was a top ally of hers, as well as a mentor. And he had been for the war, but then soon turned against it when he saw how it was being conducted. And so in 2005, he went to her and he said, you know, I think I'm going to come out in favor of withdrawal. And so she sort of worked with him to plan this announcement he was going to make. And of course, the entire anti-war caucus in the House wanted to be there with him, but she and Murtha decided that he had to do this himself. It had to look like a one-man show, essentially, in order to have the credibility and seeing that, you know, his voice would be so much more powerful than the voice of the usual suspects on the anti-war left. So he went out and he made this announcement, and it did have a huge impact on public opinion toward the war at a time when that was just starting to sort of sour. And she was asked about it, and she refused to comment, and she refused to back him. And she actually, a lot of anti-war activists were very angry at her for seeming not to support Jack Murtha's turn against the war. But in fact, this was calculated on her part. So I wouldn't call it a trick exactly, but it was a strategic omission on her part to let him do this on his own and have it be his statement alone, because she believed that would be more effective. And I think in the end, that ended up being the case.
And in apparent opposition to her. Did something like that happen with impeachment, which Pelosi was steadfastly against, at least publicly, until she was for it?
I don't think so. I don't think she was pretending to be against impeachment. I think, you know, one of the really big themes of the book is Nancy Pelosi's focus on results and her focus on getting things done above all. And I think she always saw impeachment as rather pointless, even if it was justified. And she did come around to it partly on the merits and partly because her caucus got to that position. But I think she would still look back and say, well, what did that achieve? It was divisive. It took up a lot of time and energy. It had to be done. But what came out of it? Obviously, Donald Trump was not removed from office. She would, I think, argue that he will forever have an asterisk next to his name as a president who's been impeached, and there's nothing he can do to reverse that. But I think from her perspective also, you know, it didn't feed a hungry child. It didn't give anybody health care. It didn't improve the lives of the American people in a material way. And that is what she will always say is her focus.
So she felt pushed into impeachment by her base.
I think she felt pushed into it by Trump. I think she felt that Trump's actions were so outrageous that they demanded to be censured in some way. So I don't think it was that she only caved to her caucus. And it wasn't, you know, the base of the caucus. It wasn't the liberals in the caucus that led the charge on the Ukraine issue. It was really when the more conservative members of the caucus, the so-called frontliners in the vulnerable conservative-leaning districts, they were the ones who really came around who hadn't necessarily been there before.
How about tearing up the copy of the State of the Union address on national television? Was that calculated? Does she have any regrets about that as, you know, looking like looking undignified, even behind Donald Trump as the president of the United States? How does she see that? How do you see that at this point? And in terms of any political impact for the 2020 elections?
Well, one thing you have to know about Nancy Pelosi is that she doesn't do regret. She just doesn't indulge it. It isn't. She will tell you that regret is just not something she ever does. She says that it's not in her vocabulary.
Uh-huh.
Right. Well,
no
some
regret,
of them
no
will
fear.
Say in retrospect that they made a mistake. But in that case, I don't think that was a calculated gesture. There was some analysis of, oh, did she, you know, mean to take the spotlight away from him and somehow distract or make a political point or whatever. I don't think that was the case. I think it was a spontaneous gesture. And I take her somewhat at her word that she was just that offended by the State of the Union address, the contents of the speech, which she felt was, you know, riddled with falsehoods, but also the sort of spectacle that was put on, right, with all of the people being called on to stand in the chamber, the Medal of Freedom being awarded to Rush Limbaugh. She's an institutionalist, and she regards the House as a sort of sacred space, and I think she felt that was violated by the spectacle of the speech, and I think she really was angry, and she expressed it.
Time Magazine national correspondent Molly Ball, her new book about the Speaker of the House is called Pelosi. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.